Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As a reporter for NPR, Tamara Keith has covered House Republicans as a congressional correspondent and Hillary Clinton during the 2016 presidential campaign. Now, as a White House correspondent and co-host of the NPR Politics podcast, she is following the president to his rallies, most recently in Minnesota, and reporting on the Mueller investigation. She joins us in New Hampshire today as part of the Justice in Journalism series, a collaboration between the Rudman Center at UNH Law and NHPR. What do you want to know about national politics, news from the White House, and the 2020 presidential campaign? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. We're also on Twitter and Instagram at NHPR Exchange. Tamara Keith, welcome to The Exchange.
So great to be with you.
Great to have you here. So I wanted to start by asking you about a day in the life of Tamara Keith. So what is it like? Do you wake up and go straight to the White House every day, or what is it like?
How much time do we have?
An hour, but see what you can do.
This could be a very boring story. So it just depends on the day. Morning Edition starts at 5 a.m., Morning Edition produces a podcast called Up First. The way Up First works, it's a great podcast, everyone should check it out, but the way Up First works is at 5 a.m. they do a live segment of Morning Edition that then the producers go and cut down and turn into a podcast that is posted at 6 a.m. So on days that I'm on Up First, I get a call at 4 a.m. from some poor producer at Morning Edition who has to deal with sleepy, tired Tam.
Wait, so you don't know until 4 a.m. if you have to
No. I know the night before. So, you know, the night before we sort of plot out what I'm going to be talking about, draft a script even, and then I get that 4 a.m. wake-up call, usually about 5 hours later, which is torturous. And luckily, I have a setup at home so that when I'm on the radio at 5 a.m., I'm usually wearing a bathrobe. Like, I just go upstairs to my home office and I turn on the machines and I'm able to be on the radio at 5 a.m.
So that's the beauty of radio.
It is. Yep. Oh, my gosh. It's wonderful. And then some days I go back to sleep. Other days I'm on the radio another 4 times before I get to take a shower.
Wow.
And then typically after that, I go to the office. Either I go to the White House or I go to NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. There are actually 4 of us that cover the White House for NPR. And so we have different shifts, White House AM, White House PM. But, you know, for all the best laid plans, for instance, a couple of Fridays ago, I was on Up First. And then had some interviews during the day. I was like, you know what? I am going to cut out early. It has been a long day. I was up at 4 a.m., didn't get to go back to sleep. So around 4 p.m., I cut out early, and I am almost home when word comes that the Mueller report is out. Or the Mueller report has been delivered to the attorney general. And so we all jump into action. I had already produced a piece that started airing on All Things Considered before I was even home. Mm-hmm. And then fired up the machines and I was on All Things Considered at I don't know what time, and we produced a podcast and I wasn't done working until 8 p.m.
Wow. So a long day.
Yes, those happen.
Yeah, of course, of course.
That's what we signed up for.
Exactly. Yeah, we have long days here too at the State House for a variety of stories.
Yeah.
When you go to the White House, who is your source? Because I know
maybe I can't,
you're not supposed
that.
To say, but okay. So, I ask because, you know, press briefings from Sarah Huckabee Sanders are famously few and far between. So what are you waiting for when you go there?
Right. So I did a story back in August when it started to be clear that the White House press briefings were going away. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I did an analysis pulling data from past administrations ever since the White House press briefing had been televised. And I, with the help of the data team at NPR, created this whole database of White House press briefings and was able to prove conclusively, despite what the White House was claiming at the time, that the briefings were fewer, shorter, and with less depth, though that part I wasn't able to prove with data, but I think I could.
That's a subjective kind of measure.
It is, but I think there's a way to do it. Mm-hmm. The answers were shorter.
Okay.
And so since then, it has just only gotten worse. And now the daily press briefing is daily in quotes, and it's more like the monthly daily press briefing.
Monthly daily.
Yes. Yeah. So how do I get information? I still get a lot of information from Sarah Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not on television. Last week, I just walked into her office, asked her a few questions. It was after the Barr letter had come out, and I was asking, like, well, so are you guys going to move on? And she was like, why would we move on? Of course we're not going to move on. We are going to essentially make people pay for opposing the president for the last 2 years, for hyping up the collusion delusion, as the president calls it. And, you know, that quick conversation helped crystallize for me what has clearly become a strategy of the White House. And I was able to sort of report it very early on that they are going to weaponize this as a campaign strategy. So I talked to Sarah. I talked to other people in the White House. I also often you get information about the White House by triangulating. So going up to Capitol Hill and asking members of Congress or seeing who the president has met with and then calling those people to find out what's going on.
OK. What you were describing with Sarah Huckabee Sanders reminds me of something I heard. I can't remember where I heard it, but essentially having the press briefings televised has sort of changed the nature of the information that you get and the way it's given to you, almost like it's a performance for the reporters in the room, but for the people watching.
It's a performance for everybody.
But is it still a performance when you just walk into her office and ask her a quick question? Is it the same as when it's the cameras are on?
No, it's not exactly the same. I mean, the posture of they consider us to be the fake news or whatever you want to call it, that posture is still there no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very matter of fact and civil, and there's no yelling typically.
Okay.
And you know, we have a professional working relationship that would be really boring television.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this was true before the Trump administration, but it is more true now. That there is a performative aspect of the White House press briefing because it is televised. And the press secretary, I can't remember who it was that made the decision to start televising. It was during the Clinton administration, but I can't remember which press secretary it was. I do know that he regrets that decision. He thinks that televising the briefing changed the briefing and made it, you know, people, both the reporters and the press secretary, end up performing in a way. The reporters, particularly in television, are looking to get a cutaway. They're looking to get, you know, something that they can use in their package later, or put on their network. And the press secretary, especially under President Trump, because he was watching it and grading their performance, the press secretary is also putting on a show, being overly combative at times. Because it's on television. In fact, with Sean Spicer, it was well-rated television at first.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the dynamics of reporting on Air Force One.
So Air Force One is it is a remarkable piece of machinery and a massive representation of American power and might. And just like a really cool airplane. But in terms of reporting on Air Force One, you never know when the president is going to come back on the plane. You know, by design, we wouldn't naturally have contact with the president on the plane. The press section of the plane is way far in the back. There's a giant Secret Service cabin in between us and the president. There's a staff cabin in front of the Secret Service cabin before you get to the president's part of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, we wouldn't just bump into each other. But typically, the press secretary always comes back. Back in the day, back, you know, before there were no briefings ever, this is sort of carried on to Air Force One, too. But back in the day, the press secretary or the deputy press secretary would always come back and do a briefing for reporters on the plane about, you know, what we were going to see on the ground, who the president was meeting with, and answer other questions, news of the day type questions, and they would actually pipe it back to the White House. But you, when you're on Air Force One as part of the press pool, there's probably only like five reporters there. So you have to be ready with questions for the entire press corps because there are so few of you there on the plane. But the thing is that sometimes it's not the press secretary that comes back. Sometimes it's the president. It's really hit or miss. You don't know when he's going to come back. Sometimes I think he comes back when he knows that there's a reporter in the press section who he likes or wants to talk to. So if Maggie Haberman from The New York Times is on Air Force One, it's almost certain that President Trump will come back. Mm-hmm. If Mara Liasson from NPR is in the press section, it is almost certain that President Trump will come back. John Roberts from Fox News. There are some reporters who, if they're there, there's a really decent chance that the president is going to come back and talk to the press. A lot of the time, he demands to be off the record. And then what we try to do is ask that parts of it be put on the record.
Okay. After the fact, after he says something, you say, can we use that on the record?
Yeah. And like usually we just sort of roll tape just in case, because often they let you claw it back onto the record later, and it's not a perfect system.
Well, you know, you have to sort of improvise in a way.
Yeah. And there's a loud airplane sound in the background for all of it.
To be a print reporter.
Yes, exactly.
Listeners, we've got NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith in the studio today answering your questions about what it's like to cover the White House. We'll also be talking about the reporting on the Mueller report, on 2020 presidential candidates, on sexual harassment and sexism on the campaign trail. Give us a call if you've got a question or a comment. 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. With respect to the press corps, Tamara Keith, do you see the press corps working together in concert, or are they sort of working towards independent news organization goals?
It's both. You know, we're all in this foxhole together in terms of the White House press corps. And I'm a member of the White House Correspondents Association board. We have this association where we are constantly advocating for access for all journalists, all White House journalists. And you know, it is a vigorous back and forth. We're also advocating for things like, you know, bathroom access for pool reporters when you're waiting outside of a golf course, or, you know, all kinds of really mundane things. So as a collective group of the White House correspondents, we are working together to increase access and the ability to cover the president. But then everybody is trying to get their scoops, and it's not like you're sharing your scoops with somebody else.
Right.
So when somebody does get a great scoop, it's not a, oh, man, it's a, hey, great job. Right. You know, we are a very collegial group of journalists because, again, we're all in this together.
One of the things I've wondered while watching press briefings, and I should confess, I haven't seen too many of them. So maybe this happens and I just haven't seen it.
And there haven't been many lately.
And there haven't been many anyway. But let's just say, you know, I hear a reporter answer a question. I hear Sarah Huckabee Sanders sort of dodge it. And then the reporter will either ask one follow up or sit down without a follow up. And I often wonder, like, oh, should the next person that Sarah Huckabee Sanders calls on say, wait a minute, you didn't answer that last reporter's question. I'm going to give up on my question because I really want you to answer for that other reporter.
Sometimes it happens. It doesn't happen all the time, in part because, like, you know, you go to this briefing, you're working on a story, you need an answer to the question that you're trying to get answered so that you can put that in your story.
Right.
So it's a collective action challenge. There have been a few cases of reporters who get called on because Sarah will call on somebody to, like, move on to change the subject. Change the subject or just, you know, like, halt the back and forth. And there have been a few occasions where the next reporter says, no, I'd like Hallie or whoever to be able to finish asking her follow-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And that really bothered the White House. a lot.
Well, you're taking away a tactic that enables them to not answer the question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk to Heidi in Francistown. Heidi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, it's wonderful to have you on our show, to have your guest on the show. My concern is this, that in the 2016 election, candidate Trump got a tremendous amount of attention, and my feeling about the press coverage was that he was a very exciting, entertaining candidate. And even though most of the press, from what I could tell, was not really taking him seriously as somebody who should be president, but he was so much fun. And I think that, of course, I think that that was a terrible mistake, because it cast other more, well, certainly qualified and more serious candidates into the shade somehow. And candidate Trump benefited enormously from the excitement in a way, almost kind of joyful pleasure that the press took in covering somebody so colorful but not qualified. And I wonder if the press has given any thought to not doing that sort of thing again.
Heidi, thanks very much for the call. Thank you very much. Really appreciate your call. What do you think, Tamara Keith?
Well, certainly in the early stages of the campaign and well into the campaign, President Trump, or then candidate Trump, was really good television. And the television networks, well, the cable networks, in particular CNN, would just carry his rallies live because you didn't know what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that CNN has reflected on that and determined that it was a mistake. Certainly now the president continues to have rallies, and none of the cable networks are carrying them live anymore. Even Fox News is not carrying most of his rallies live in the lead up to the midterms. They just stopped carrying the rallies live. These cable networks are driven by one thing. Well, they're driven by many things, but one thing that they are really driven by is ratings. And he was getting good ratings. He's not getting as good a ratings now. Fox, in one case, determined that Hannity was getting better ratings than airing a Trump rally during Hannity. So then Hannity's show was back on.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that there has been something of a shift. But if the president does something newsworthy, then it gets covered. At the rally I was at recently, he said BS, but he didn't say BS. And he also, used some nicknames and really criticized Congressman Adam Schiff, who is the head of the House Intelligence Committee. And, you know, the key with covering these things is to put it in context.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the president says a cuss word in an arena full of people, that is actually news that needs to be covered. But it, you know, you don't have to air the entire rally to find out if he's going to cuss.
Right. To Heidi's point, though, aside from covering an entire rally live, there were things that Trump said as a candidate that did get a lot of coverage. Like, for example, early on in his campaign when he called, I think it was Mexican immigrants, some of them were rapists.
Yeah.
That was very incendiary. It got a lot of attention because, oh, my God, a candidate actually said something like that. And then I think what Heidi may have thought was that the press didn't think that would resonate with people as much as it did in certain places. So how do you go about, you know, covering that while also being sort of responsible and ethical? And I think that's what Heidi's sort of getting at. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to refer to the press as this monolith, and the press isn't a monolith. And even within NPR itself, there are hundreds of small decisions that are being made every single day about our coverage. And that adds up to something. And And we are always trying to figure out how to do the right thing, how to cover things most accurately and effectively. And you know, some decisions are better than other decisions. And on the whole, we hope that we're doing the right thing. But it's not this. There is not a right answer. And I think that it's easy to seem. Sometimes it seems from the outside like there is just one right answer, but it's. It's not. It's just not that easy.
I should add that I don't have the answer, but I'm interested in the question. I think it's a fascinating one because
yes.
Who knows what we'll encounter this cycle?
Absolutely, and certainly when a presidential candidate is saying things like that, you, as much as people in the audience might want us to completely ignore it, you can't ignore it because. You know, he said those things about Mexican immigrants, and now he's done an emergency declaration to try to build a wall on the border, and he is threatening to close the border, which would have massive economic impacts. All of that flows out from his view of Mexico.
Mm-hmm. So worth covering. Certainly.
Yes.
We got a question from Julia, who says, how does Tamara view the treatment of men and women correspondents in the White House? Are they treated equally? Or are there any differences?
I think that we're pretty equal. Now, maybe that's me putting on rose-colored glasses or something. But, you know, there are a lot of women in the press corps. There are days when in the briefing room, the first row is all women. We have come a long way from a press corps that was completely male-dominated. And I have never felt like I was treated differently. Because of my gender at the White House, certainly.
Listeners, we've got NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith in the studio with us this morning. She's answering your questions about what it's like to be a reporter covering the White House. We'll also talk about some stories that have been in the news lately, including the Mueller report and how that has fallen in the White House. Give us a call if you have questions. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a question on Facebook. You can find us on Facebook by searching for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. I'm Peter Biello, filling in today for Laura Kanoy. We'll be right back.
That old World Wide Web just turned 30, and it looks like it's here to stay. It's no secret, to keep your business relevant, you have to have a digital strategy. As an NHPR underwriter, your business can reach our ever-growing digital audience through our many podcasts, our e-newsletter, or at our award-winning news site, nhpr.org. Learn more about how you can reach our engaged online audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy, and we're speaking today with NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Give us a call if you have questions or comments. The number is 1-800-892-6477. So big news recently is that Special Counsel Robert Mueller wrapped up his report. We've seen calls from congressional Democrats for Attorney General William Barr to release the entire report. The White House has said that the results vindicate the president. Tamara, you were at the president's rally in Minnesota last week where he said, quote, after 3 years of the lies and smears and slander, the Russia hoax is finally dead. What was the attitude of voters at this rally that you spoke to about the report?
And the collusion delusion.
The collusion delusion.
Is over, I think he said. Just one small fact check. It was in Michigan.
It was in Michigan. Excuse me.
Other state up north in the middle. So, I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I do when I go to these rallies, I was interviewing people outside of the rally on their way in and thought, hey, let's ask people. If they want the full Mueller report released. And I don't know why I was surprised, but everyone I talked to was either okay with it or really, really wanted it released. One woman said, like, it needs to be released because they won't be satisfied unless it's released. And then she was like, well, they won't be satisfied anyway, but I do think it should be released.
Mm-hmm.
Another man was like, yeah, let's get it out there. Another said that, he thought that it would help the president to have that report out there because they feel like, you know, that the top lines that Bill Barr had in his letter indicate that the president is clear. So let's just get it out there. That was a pretty uniform opinion, which it turns out is also reflected in polling. The NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll that came out the next morning showed that 75% of people believe the full report should be released.
Mm-hmm. And so what will you be watching for going forward?
Oh, my gosh. One thing that the letter that Bill Barr wrote did not get into, really, was the counterintelligence portion of the investigation, the questions of what did Russia do and how did they do it. Now, a lot of information has been in the indictments that Mueller and his team filed against numerous Russians and Russian entities related to the hacking and also the misinformation efforts during 2016. But I'm really curious to see how Mueller wrote that up. Certainly, we know of a lot of contacts between Trump people in the Trump orbit and Russians over the course of the campaign. We know that President Trump said, you know, Russia, if you're listening, please go find Hillary Clinton's emails. The press will reward you mightily. And it turns out, I mean, they got John Podesta's emails and the press did reward them mightily in a way, and that there was coverage, some of which I did, of, you know, the details of these emails because you were getting an inside look at a presidential campaign and sort of the internal workings of a presidential campaign. How does Mueller handle all of that? One other huge question is Mueller did not decide on obstruction of justice as relates to the president. He said that, you know, the Barr letter has just a very few actual quotes from the Mueller report. But one of those quotes says that Mueller, in his conclusions, neither exonerated nor I don't know what the right word is. Convicted isn't the right word, but it didn't weigh in on whether the president had committed obstruction of justice. Barr himself then did weigh in, along with the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, and said, we don't believe that this is prosecutable. We don't believe that this should be pursued. But what did Mueller actually say?
Mm-hmm.
How did he characterize his decision not to decide on obstruction, to sort of leave that hanging out there? That is a great big mystery.
In your conversations with people who support the president, what else were they concerned about policy-wise? Was there anything that really stood out? Was it a mishmash of things?
Yeah, I mean, I was specifically asking about health care because the president had just made, or the White House had just made this decision to support a lawsuit that would, if it succeeds, completely throw out all aspects of the Affordable Care Act. And you know, they were sort of a mixed view. The answer was basically like, we trust him and he's going to figure this out. And maybe we don't fully understand the strategy right now or what the healthcare plan would be, but we know that there will be great healthcare.
Mm-hmm. And he's sort of describing the Republican Party as the party of great healthcare now.
He is, though, really, really interestingly, now, after a week of saying Republicans will be the party of great healthcare, now we're going to get a plan. We're going to have a plan. It's going to be a great plan. Now he's saying, well, it turns out which is obvious, we can't pass something with Democrats controlling the House and Republicans controlling the Senate. So we're going to do this after 2020.
Hmm.
And that is a reflection of political reality, that you aren't going to get a great Republican health care plan with Democrats controlling the House. But the lawsuit is still hanging out there. The potential exists for a legal decision that throws out the entire Affordable Care Act. And it turns out the president is saying they aren't going to work on a plan to replace it until after 2020.
So we may have nothing if it's thrown out.
Yeah, I mean, the odds of that happening seem pretty low. Most legal experts think that these legal arguments are dubious at best. And it may be a case of the dog hoping not to catch the tailpipe.
Okay.
But wanting to signal, like, you know, that the president and his administration is signaling, we are going to do everything to get rid of the Affordable Care Act without, they hope, having to actually get rid of the Affordable Care Act without being ready.
Wasn't that kind of what the Congress did for a long time when President Obama was in office? Like voting and voting and voting, knowing it would go nowhere?
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah, there was a lot of... It's signaling. And that happens, certainly. You know, there's an argument that with the emergency declaration on the wall that the president... I mean, he said that day that he made the announcement, I know this is going to get tied up in the courts, but it enables him to say he did everything he possibly could to keep a promise.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk to Matt in Gilmanton. Matt, thanks very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Well, first of all, this is one of the most interesting shows I've heard in a while. Really, really enjoying everything.
Thank you.
Struck by what you said about Sarah Huckabee Sanders kind of dropping her guard and maybe turning off the act a little bit when you're in closed doors. And I'm not sure I'm going to like an answer to this either way, but is there a similar effect with the president when he's hanging out on the tail end of Air Force One? I mean, is there a normal guy somewhere underneath there? What's it like when it's just you and a couple reporters and the president? Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Those conversations are off the record, but I will say that, and I think I can say this without giving anything away, but he's relatively jovial, jokey, he in some ways seems to be seeking the approval of the reporters. I mean, I think that there's a line in an interview that he did with the New York Times that, and I'm not going to quote this exactly, but I think that gets at some of the dynamic between him and reporters, where he says, like, you know, can't a guy from Queens just get one good story in the New York Times? and I think that sort of sums up his posture in less formal settings. He doesn't spend a lot of time calling us the enemy of the people. But the reality is, it doesn't matter. If he's calling us the enemy of the people in public, and that's what people see, that's what matters.
Mm-hmm. I have an email question from Alex, who said, do you believe a court ruling striking down the entirety of the ACA would increase the chances of Medicare for All or a similar proposal becoming law?
Potentially. The U.S. health system is incredibly complicated, and the Affordable Care Act is not just the things that you think it is. The Affordable Care Act, in many ways, fundamentally changed the U.S. healthcare system. And so if that were to go away, I'm not even quite sure I understand how it would unwind. I don't think anybody fully understands how it would unwind. The reality is that the political dynamics are such that passing Medicare for All would be very, very, very difficult, which is why Democrats sometimes talk about, well, if there's a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, then maybe we should do away with the legislative filibuster, because they think that's the only way you could get Medicare for All passed.
Hmm. Since we're talking about Medicare for All, might make sense to talk about 2020, since that's going to be one of the biggest issues.
Yeah.
And let's start the conversation on 2020 by talking with Nathan from Keene. Nathan, thank you very much for your call. What's on your mind?
All right. Well, thank you, Tamara, for being here. Welcome to New Hampshire, and we really appreciate your tenacious reporting, so thank you.
It's good to be back in New Hampshire.
There you go. Well, so my question is just more from a in our hyper-partisan climate, what is your take on people entering public service, which is something that we hear David Brooks mention on his take in the NewsHour periodically, is that, you know, this hyper-partisan environment is going to stifle people wanting to enter public roles and various forms of government. And my question is, you know, as you look at people who, one, are already in government careers, how has this climate sort of affected people who are in government agencies with somewhat of a revolving door of cabinet positions and different influences and tones that are struck in the different agencies? But then secondly, for people who are evaluating, you know, coming out of their degrees in grad school and possibly going into federal work, you know, how does this sort of political environment that you're observing affect their choices? Is it something that's motivating or something that they just don't want to get involved in?
I mean, Thank you very much, Nathan.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, there was certainly a very real concern, and I don't think that we have data to back it up at this point, but there was a very real concern that a 35-day government shutdown where federal workers were not getting paid and were not being well taken care of, that a 35-day government shutdown would, you know, affect the calculation that people make down the line about their careers. I mean, I certainly have friends who are public employees who were looking for jobs in the private sector during the government shutdown, not like to drive Uber or you know, sell cupcakes to hold them over during the shutdown, but to completely change their careers. And that's a really sad thing because public servants are, you know, they have made sacrifices. They are choosing likely less pay for the reward of helping the public good. That said, some partisanship, some, you know, turnover in cabinet positions, that is part of being a public employee, is that at the higher echelons, things are unstable. Not typically as unstable as they've been, but, you know, that there is turnover, that there are partisan changes. And you know, federal workers are really good at doing their jobs, putting their heads down, and just, you know, doing the work that they got into it to do. That said, you know, there is certainly frustration out there that I've heard, and it does become a question: do you, you know, when you're a young person, do you go become a Foreign Service officer, or do you do something else with your life?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that we, you know, I don't know that it's clear yet whether this is really having an impact or not. I think it's something that you would have to track over time.
We got a question from Michael who wanted to know if you felt that the current national Democratic strategy of intersectional and identity politics is going to be a winner for Democrats.
Well, I think that potentially it's a winner with Democrats. It's a winner among Democrats, certainly. Well,
maybe independents? Maybe
yeah,
that's a better question?
Well, and I think that identity politics is a pretty loaded term. And you could argue that there are identity politics on the Republican side, too. And it's a different identity that they're talking about. But there's absolutely identity politics all around. And in terms of Democrats, you know, a key part of the Democratic electorate, is more diverse than the Republican electorate. The Democratic electorate is intersectional. And those voters, you know, in the past, sometimes candidates have not been as vocal about those issues. And those voters didn't feel seen. And you need, Democrats need all of their electorate to be excited.
We're talking with NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith in this hour. And when we come back from the break, we're going to talk more about the presidential campaigns to come and the one she covered in the past, Hillary Clinton, her campaign as well, what lessons may have been learned by the media at large, and maybe what Tamara Keith has learned from that experience as well. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. If you have questions or comments, you can also send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. This is The Exchange. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in today for Laura Kanoy, and we are speaking with NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Give us a call if you have a question for her. The number is 1-800-892-6477. If you'd rather email, the address is exchange@nhpr.org. And we're going to talk about presidential campaigns, past and future. Listeners, which candidates are you watching? Do you have a favorite? Someone you want to talk about? If you voted for President Trump, what do you want to hear from him on the campaign trail? We'd love to hear your thoughts and get Tamara Keith's response to them. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. So, Tamara Keith, in 2016, you covered Hillary Clinton. You were on the road with her. After the election, a lot of people were critical of how the media covered the president. Looking back on your coverage of the Clinton campaign, what lessons do you think you've learned from that coverage to take into this new race?
Well, one thing I learned is that I should have spent more time covering President Trump, too. We were supposed to swap out more, and it just logistically became challenging. And
reporters were supposed to sort of switch campaigns.
Yes, we were supposed to switch campaigns. And
can you explain, first of all, the logic behind that? Why would an editor want to do that with reporters?
And I will say that I only switched out one time, and it was in August of 2016. I was supposed to do a week, and the logistics were so terrible, and the Trump campaign didn't tell me where they were going next, that I only made it about a day and a half before they lost me.
Hmm.
And then, anyway, it was, but, you know, the logic is, one, you don't know who's going to win, and it's important for your reporters to know the staff and the candidate who could end up being the president. So you need to know both. The other logic is that fresh eyes are a good thing, that even in that short time that I covered the Trump campaign, you know, out on the road, I saw things that the reporter who had been with him for day in, day out for months couldn't see anymore. And the same with them covering Clinton. Like fresh eyes are a very good thing because you're just in the bubble and you're on the road and you're exhausted and you're seeing the same speech 100 times and you just get sort of your eyes glaze over. And switching out helps you see things differently.
I see. Was that a response to how things had been covered previously? Because I'm thinking back, and maybe my memory is not serving me, but in 2008, I think NPR had dedicated reporters, one per campaign for Barack Obama and John McCain.
But they swapped.
They did swap? Okay,
yeah.
So that's where my memory is failing me.
Yeah, there are swaps, you know, and it was only for a week or two, but, it, you know, there are the great tarmac swaps that happen
okay.
when, you know, the two private planes are there and the reporter, like, swaps at the time. So, I mean, going forward, My feeling is that I and my editors agree with this, that although I am covering President Trump and that is the campaign that I am covering, I will swap in and cover the Democrats more. Simply, we just did the logistics didn't work out last time and we should have worked harder at it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that although it is great to be in the bubble with the candidate and fly on the plane and go to all the places, sometimes you can't slow down and see things because you are in that bubble and you're just run, and you're exhausted. And so it is my intention this time around, and it'll be easier because I'm covering the president, but it's my intention this time around to, you know, not necessarily always fly out with the candidate, but instead, like, spend a little time on the ground and really see things outside of the arena or the rally hall.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is different about the 2020 race that you could compare to 2016? How is it different?
Well, it's almost in some ways, and people might yell at me about this, but in some ways it's a mirror image.
Hmm.
Because now you have a Democratic field with 16 or whatever the number is candidates. You have this huge Democratic field, and you have a couple of candidates. Certainly, Bernie Sanders has this solid base of support. We don't quite know how big it is, but much like candidate Trump ended up with this sort of solid base of support that did not erode.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether Sanders is going to be able to hold on to that solid base of support isn't clear yet, because this is only just beginning. But it is this huge field of many highly qualified candidates, a lot of senators, much like it was in 2016 in the Republican primary. And watching how the winnowing works will be interesting. Will people take their ride up the escalator and fall off a cliff of popularity? Or will there be people who ride up and then stay on the top? We don't know.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk to Scott in Keene. Scott, thanks very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm really interested in Pete Buttigieg. He's one of the most refreshing candidates I've seen in a long time. And I just would love to hear Tamara's take on the possibility of a millennial gay man becoming president.
Well, there you go. What
do
you think?
Have you met him yet?
I have not met him. I've watched all of the interviews I can find online, but I've not met him.
And did you donate to his campaign?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. The thing with Pete Buttigieg is he's sort of taking off through the internet in a way, and people seeing his town hall on CNN, and a lot of people have given to his campaign in part to make sure that he makes it onto the debate stage. And I think that these debates are going to really, much as they did on the Republican side, they're going to help voters figure out who has a presence and who is saying the things on the issues that they really want to hear. You know, certainly Buttigieg raising $7 million, not as much as Bernie Sanders or Kamala Harris, but given that he is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who didn't have a big list of potential campaign donors before he came into this, is a pretty remarkable thing. And I'm hearing from more and more voters like Scott who are intrigued by him and wondering how it'll turn out. But one thing that's been interesting, because this field is so huge, I've heard from a lot of people who have donated to more than one candidate.
Mm-hmm. In part because some candidates need to have a certain number of donors to get on the debate stage, right?
Yep.
And some people just want to see them debate, and
yes,
that's what they need to do.
Right. They need 65,000 donors, individual donors, to get on the debate stage. Buttigieg and Andrew Yang are a couple of candidates who, you know, were not as well known and had supporters who were like almost running a campaign, give a dollar so he can get on the debate stage.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I thought interesting about Scott's comment is that he talked about Buttigieg as a millennial and a gay man. But nothing about his policy. And that's not a criticism of Scott's comment. I think a lot of people think that way. But it goes back to our question earlier about identity politics. Are people focusing the right amount on identity and the right amount about policy, or is there an imbalance there?
I don't know the right answer. You know, what I have learned over time covering politics is that as much as we all want to do stories about policy and think that policy really matters, in the end, a lot of people are making their decisions based on something more qualitative.
Mm-hmm.
And in polls and in conversations with voters, what is the most important thing to Democrats right now? Finding a nominee who can defeat President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Burrow in on that. What do you think that is? Everyone has a different answer.
Just for Democrats, maybe whatever collection of Democratic policies that you hold will be worlds better than what President Trump is pushing.
I mean, it seems like, even the most conservative Democrats are running on things that Democrats would consider to be just fine.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of story would you hope to see come out of maybe the NPR newsroom, maybe something that you'd like to do or something that you think another reporter would be better equipped to do that you really think would be beneficial for people to see during this campaign season?
Oh, gosh. You know, I think I still think we should focus on policy,
mm-hmm.
even though maybe it isn't the determining factor for a lot of voters. But I do think that better understanding what the candidates mean when they say Medicare for all. I think on a lot of these issues, there are catchphrases, but what's below that catchphrase?
Mm-hmm. What do you think the impact of having so many female candidates is going to do this time around?
Well, one thing that it has done, and my colleague Danielle Kurtzleben really keyed in on this in a great piece. One thing it has done is, you know, when Hillary Clinton was running for president both times, she kept getting questions about, like, how is your gender going to affect your campaign?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now the men are getting the question, too. How is your gender going to affect this campaign? Because no longer is being a male candidate for president the default on the Democratic side. In the early days when candidates were announcing, the majority of candidates were women and people of color or women of color. And that is, that is a totally different situation than it was 4 years ago or 12 years ago. or, you know, 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, give us a call if you have a question. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Greg in Tamworth. Greg, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Peter. Good morning, Tam. I am a huge fan of yours. I live in Tamworth. I moved to Tamworth just so I could be Tam-worthy of your my worship for you. I think you're terrific, and I know you have a new baby, and I'm in awe of what you're able to do.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. I hope you get to spend quality time. But anyway, I'm calling because what I see with the candidates coming up on the Democratic side is not just a group of candidates, but it's more like a flash mob. There are new people coming up every couple of days. And I have to be honest, there are some interesting, exciting people, but it's sort of like training camp for a sports team. Some of them are rookies that in time will be important players, but right now I have to say I don't see any that I consider to be a president. I think it's there's time yet to go, Joe Biden, and there are other people that I'd like to see enter the race. But I wanted to just speak specifically to Hillary Clinton. Trump the other day said that he got 63 million votes. Well, that's impressive in a certain way, but she got 66. She got at least 3 million more votes than he did. And she won the election, but she didn't get to be president. He was appointed president by the Electoral College. And I think that has to be modified. I don't think the college can be abolished, but it should be such that we don't have these state-by-state winner-take-all races so that somebody can accumulate those electoral votes, even though they don't win the popular vote. I heard somebody say that if you tallied up what Jill Stein got, and if those votes had gone to Hillary, she would have won. So I just like your thoughts about that. I think one more thing. I just think it's a shame that as this procession of candidates has come out, that there were people that just did not want her to run again. And we're relieved that she didn't. And I think that's a shame. If she had been a man, people would be clamoring for her to run again. So,
well, Greg, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Tim or Keith?
Yeah, and, you know, certainly Mitt Romney, people were not saying, Mitt Romney, go away. Mitt Romney's now in the Senate, mm-hmm. which is kind of mind-blowing in a way, because to see him walking around in the Capitol, you're like, wait. You're Mitt Romney.
Blast from the past in a
way. Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of the Electoral College, you're right. There is a lot of conversation happening, particularly on the Democratic side, because of that frustration that Hillary Clinton got so many more popular votes and yet did not win in the Electoral College. And, you know, the same thing happened in the year 2000. It wasn't, you know, in the same numbers, but that, you know, the Electoral College and then the Supreme Court, you know, affected the outcome in the year 2000. Actually changing the Electoral College is something that would be incredibly difficult. And so at this point, it's more of a sort of parlor game conversation. It's not clear where it goes. But, you know, I think that you see the frustration expressed in the number of people who want to talk about sort of these procedural things, mm-hmm. You know, talk about the Electoral College, the size of the Supreme Court, and the number of people who are talking about getting rid of the legislative filibuster in the Senate. All of these things are an outgrowth of frustration that Democrats have had.
Mm-hmm. I want to end the show on kind of a lighter note, because in your bio on the NPR website, you said that you're a softball player in a team that also play a softball player in a team made of media professionals. Who faces regularly a team of congresswomen.
Yes, and I would say none of us are softball professionals.
but you're working on it.
But we take ourselves very seriously.
Very seriously.
Though we were supposed to have practice Monday morning, and it was too cold. We decided that 32 degrees is too cold to play softball. So we are hoping spring will really spring in the few days, and we can start practice next Monday. So it is. We are called the Bad News Babes. The Congress team does not have a cool name.
What is their name, even if it's not cool?
It's the Congress.
The Congresswoman team.
Yeah, okay. There's no. And so We only play one game a year. It is a charitable operation to raise money for the Young Survival Coalition, which is a charity for young women with cancer diagnosis. It was originally organized by Debbie Wasserman Schultz. It is a bipartisan thing. The Congress team is Republicans and Democrats. And I feel that we as the media team are here for the good of America to give them a common enemy in this softball game. One big open question going forward for the 2020 and 2019, mostly the 2019 softball game, is that the pitcher, the primary pitcher on the members' team is Kirsten Gillibrand, senator from New York, who is running for president.
Yep.
And the announcer is Amy Klobuchar. So the person
really?
Who announces the game is also running for president. So what is going to happen with our game? My hope is that Senator Gillibrand, who is a pretty good pitcher and practices very hard and is quite fierce and very, very competitive, my hope, and she's a good hitter too, my hope is that she will be so busy running for president that she will not have time to practice pitching.
Oh, that's a shame. Well, tell us about her pitching style. I mean, does she throw inside? Does she scare you off the plate a little bit?
No.
No? Not that vicious?
Not that vicious.
Okay.
But she is intense. Like, the look on her face, you don't want to mess around. And it's softball, so it's the big lobbing. It's not fast pitch.
It's not fast pitch.
It is decidedly slow pitch.
Okay, because that can be pretty terrifying to have a softball hurled at you at top speed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and I play catcher, so my shins take a lot.
Well, we certainly appreciate your being here today, Tamara Keith, and sharing your insights both on softball, but especially on political reporting and covering the White House. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find links to some of Tamara Keith's reporting at nhpr.org, of course, at npr.org. She's got a ton of reporting up. She's here in New Hampshire as part of the Justice and Journalism Series, a collaboration between the Rudman Center at UNH Law and NPR. And that's it for today, but the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our public radio fellow is Ali Oshinsky. Dan Tui helps out from time to time digitally wise, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.